and private hot tub for each one. I had a butler. When she got to each casino, her gambling habits took over almost as soon as she walked in. She would often play for hours at a stretch. She started small at first, using only the casino's money. Then the numbers got larger, and she would replenish her chips with withdrawals from the ATM. It didn't seem to her like there was a problem. Eventually, she was playing $200 to $300 per hand, two hands at a time, sometimes for a dozen hours at a time. One night, she won $60,000. Twice, she walked away up $40,000. One time, she went to Vegas with $100,000 in her bag and came home with nothing. It didn't really change her lifestyle. Her bank account was still so large that she never had to think about money. That's why her parents had left her the inheritance in the first place, so she could enjoy herself. She would try to slow down, but the casino's appeals became more insistent. One host told me that he would get fired if I didn't come in that weekend, she said. They would say, "We sent you to this concert and we gave you this nice room, and you haven't been gambling that much lately." Well, they did do those nice things for me. In 2005, her husband's grandmother died, and the family went back to her old hometown for the funeral. She went to the casino the night before the service to clear her head and get mentally prepared for all the activity the next day. Over a span of 12 hours, she lost $250,000. At the time, it was almost as if the scale of the loss didn't register. When she thought about it afterward, $250,000 gone. It didn't seem real. She had lied to herself about so much already. That her marriage was happy when she and her husband sometimes went days without really speaking. That her friends were close when she knew they appeared for Vegas trips and were gone when it was over. That she was a good mom when she saw her daughters making the same mistake she had made, getting pregnant too early. That her parents would have been pleased to see their money thrown away this way. It felt like there were only two choices. Continue lying to herself, or admit that she had dishonored everything her mother and father had worked so hard to earn. $250,000. She didn't tell her husband. I concentrated on something new whenever that night popped into my mind, she said. Soon, though, the losses were too big to ignore. Some nights after her husband was asleep, Bachman would crawl out of bed, sit at the kitchen table, and scribble out figures, trying to make sense of how much was gone. The depression that had started after her parents' death seemed to be getting deeper. She felt so tired all the time. And Harris kept calling. This desperation starts once you realize how much you've lost. And then you feel like you can't stop, because you've got to win it back, she said. Sometimes I'd start feeling jumpy, like I couldn't think straight, and I'd know that if I pretended I might take another trip soon, it would calm me down. Then they would call, and I'd say yes, because it was so easy to give in. I really believed I might win it back. I'd won before. If you couldn't win, then gambling wouldn't be legal, right? In 2010, a cognitive neuroscientist named Riza Habib asked 22 people to lie inside an MRI and watch a slot machine spin around and around. Half of the participants were pathological gamblers. People who had lied to their families about their gambling, missed work to gamble, or had bounced checks at a casino, while the other half were people who gambled socially but didn't exhibit any problematic behaviors. Everyone was placed on their backs inside a narrow tube and told to watch wheels of lucky sevens, apples, and gold bars spin across a video screen. The slot machine was programmed to deliver three outcomes, a win, a loss, and a near miss, in which the slots almost matched up, but at the last moment, failed to align. None of the participants won or lost any money. All they had to do was watch the screen as the MRI recorded their neurological activity. We were particularly interested in looking at the brain systems involved in habits and addictions, Habib told me. What we found was that, neurologically speaking, pathological gamblers got more excited about winning. When the symbols lined up, even though they didn't actually win any money, the areas in their brains related to emotion and reward were much more active than in non-pathological gamblers. But what was really interesting were the near misses. To pathological gamblers, near misses looked like wins. Their brains reacted almost the same way. But to a non-pathological gambler, a near miss was like a loss. People without a gambling problem were better at recognizing that a near miss means you still lose. Two groups saw the exact same event, but from a neurological perspective, they viewed it differently. People with gambling problems got a mental high from the near misses, which Habib hypothesizes is probably why they gamble for so much longer than everyone else, because the near miss triggers those habits that prompt them to put down another bet. The non-problem gamblers, when they saw a near miss, got a dose of apprehension that triggered a different habit, the one that says, I should quit before it gets worse. It's unclear if problem gamblers' brains are different because they are born that way, or if sustained exposure to slot machines, online poker, and casinos can change how the brain functions. What is clear is that real neurological differences impact how pathological gamblers process information, which helps explain why Angie Bachman lost control every time she walked into a casino. Gaming companies are well aware of this tendency, of course, which is why in the past decades, slot machines have been reprogrammed to deliver a more constant supply of near wins. Gamblers who keep betting after near wins are what make casinos, racetracks, and state lotteries so profitable. Adding a near miss to a lottery is like pouring jet fuel on a fire, said a state lottery consultant who spoke to me on the condition of anonymity. You want to know why sales have exploded? Every other scratch-off ticket is designed to make you feel like you almost won. The areas of the brain that Habib scrutinized in his experiment, the basal ganglia and the brainstem, are the same regions where habits reside, as well as where behaviors during sleep terrors start. In the past decade, as new classes of pharmaceuticals have emerged that target that region, such as medications for Parkinson's disease, we've learned a great deal about how sensitive some habits can be to outside stimulation. Class action lawsuits in the United States, Australia, and Canada have been filed against drug manufacturers, alleging that pharmaceuticals caused patients to compulsively bet, eat, shop, and masturbate by targeting the circuitry involved in the habit loop. In 2008, a federal jury in Minnesota awarded a patient $8.2 million in a lawsuit against a drug company after the man claimed that his medication had caused him to gamble away more than $250,000. Hundreds of similar cases are pending. In those cases, we can definitively say that patients have no control over their obsessions, because we can point to a drug that impacts their neurochemistry, said Habib. But when we look at the brains of people who are obsessive gamblers, they look very similar, except they can't blame it on a medication. They tell researchers they don't want to gamble, but they can't resist the cravings. So why do we say that those gamblers are in control of their actions and the Parkinson's patients aren't? On March 18, 2006, Angie Bachman flew to a casino at Harrah's invitation. By then, her bank account was almost empty. When she tried to calculate how much she had lost over a lifetime, she put the figure at about $900,000. She had told Harris that she was almost broke. But the man on the phone said to come anyway. They would give her a line of credit, he said. It felt like I couldn't say no. Like whenever they dangled the smallest temptation in front of me, my brain would shut off. I know that sounds like an excuse. But they always promised it would be different this time. And I knew no matter how much I fought against it, I was eventually going to give in. She brought the last of her money with her. She started playing $400 a hand, two hands at a time. If she could get up a little bit, she told herself, just $100,000, she could quit and have something to give her kids. Her husband joined her for a while, but at midnight he went to bed. Around 2 a.m., the money she had come with was gone. A Harris employee gave her a promissory note to sign. Six times she signed for more cash, for a total of $125,000. At about 6 in the morning, she hit a hot streak, and her piles of chips began to grow. A crowd gathered. She did a quick tally. Not quite enough to pay off the notes she had signed, but if she kept playing smart, she would come out on top, and then quit for good. She won 5 times in a row. She only needed to win $20,000 more to pull ahead. Then, the dealer hit 21. Then he hit it again. A few hands later, he hit it a third time. By 10 in the morning, all her chips were gone. She asked for more credit, but the casino said no. Bachman left the table dazed and walked to her suite. It felt like the floor was shaking. She trailed a hand along the wall so that if she fell, she'd know which way to lean. When she got to the room, her husband was waiting for her. "It's all gone," she told him. "Why don't you take a shower and go to bed?" he said. "It's okay. You've lost before." "It's all gone," she said.
"What do you mean?"
"The money is gone," she said. "All of it."
"At least we still have the house," he said.
She didn't tell him that she'd taken out a line of credit on their home and had gambled it away. 4. Brian Thomas murdered his wife. Angie Bachman squandered her inheritance. Is there a difference in how society should assign responsibility? Thomas's lawyer argued that his client wasn't culpable for his wife's death because he acted unconsciously, automatically, his reaction cued by the belief that an intruder was attacking. He never chose to kill, his lawyer said, and so he shouldn't be held responsible for her death. By the same logic, Bachman, as we know from Riza Habib's research on the brains of problem gamblers, was also driven by powerful cravings. She may have made a choice that first day when she got dressed up and decided to spend the afternoon in a casino, and perhaps in the weeks or months that followed. But years later, by the time she was losing $250,000 in a single night, after she was so desperate to fight the urges that she moved to a state where gambling wasn't legal, she was no longer making conscious decisions. Historically, in neuroscience, we've said that people with brain damage lose some of their free will, said Habib. But when a pathological gambler sees a casino, it seems very similar. It seems like they're acting without choice. Thomas's lawyer argued, in a manner that everyone believed, that his client had made a terrible mistake and would carry the guilt of it for life. However, isn't it clear that Bachman feels much the same way? "I feel so guilty, so ashamed of what I've done," she told me. "I feel like I've let everyone down. I know that I'll never be able to make up for this, no matter what I do." That said, there is one critical distinction between the cases of Thomas and Bachman. Thomas murdered an innocent person.
He committed what has always been the gravest of crimes. Angie Bachman lost money. The only victims were herself, her family, and a $27 billion company that loaned her $125,000. Thomas was set free by society, and Bachman was held accountable for her deeds. 10 months after Bachman lost everything, Harris tried to collect from her bank. The promissory notes she signed bounced, and so Harris sued her, demanding Bachman pay her debts and an additional $375,000 in penalties, a civil punishment, in effect, for committing a crime. She countersued, claiming that by extending her credit, free sweets, and booze, Harris had preyed on someone they knew had no control over her habits. Her case went all the way to the state Supreme Court. Bachman's lawyer, echoing the arguments that Thomas's attorney had made on the murderer's behalf, said that she shouldn't be held culpable because she had been reacting automatically to temptations that Harris put in front of her. Once the offers started rolling in, he argued, once she walked into the casino, her habits took over, and it was impossible for her to control her behavior. The justices, acting on behalf of society, said Bachman was wrong. There is no common law duty obligating a casino operator to refrain from attempting to entice or contact gamblers that it knows or should know are compulsive gamblers, the court wrote. Indiana had a voluntary exclusion program in which any person could ask for their name to be placed upon a list that required casinos to bar them from playing. And the existence of the voluntary exclusion program suggests the legislature intended pathological gamblers to take personal responsibility to prevent and protect themselves against compulsive gambling, wrote Justice Robert Rucker. Perhaps the difference in outcomes for Thomas and Bachman is fair. After all, it's easier to sympathize with a devastated widower than a housewife who threw everything away. Why is it easier, though? Why does it seem the bereaved husband is a victim, while the bankrupt gambler got her just deserts? Why do some habits seem like they should be so easy to control, while others seem out of reach? More important, is it right to make a distinction in the first place? Some thinkers, Aristotle wrote in Nicomachean Ethics, hold that it is by nature that people become good, others that it is by habit, and others that it is by instruction. For Aristotle, habits reigned supreme. The behaviors that occur unthinkingly are the evidence of our truest selves, he said. So just as a piece of land has to be prepared beforehand if it is to nourish the seed, so the mind of the pupil has to be prepared in its habits if it is to enjoy and dislike the right things. Habits are not as simple as they appear. As I've tried to demonstrate throughout this book, habits, even once they are rooted in our minds, aren't destiny. We can choose our habits once we know how. Everything we know about habits, from neurologists studying amnesiacs and organizational experts remaking companies, is that any of them can be changed if you understand how they function. Hundreds of habits influence our days. They guide how we get dressed in the morning, talk to our kids, and fall asleep at night. They impact what we eat for lunch, how we do business, and whether we exercise or have a beer after work. Each of them has a different cue and offers a unique reward. Some are simple, and others are complex, drawing upon emotional triggers and offering subtle neurochemical prizes. But every habit, no matter its complexity, is malleable. The most addicted alcoholics can become sober. The most dysfunctional companies can transform themselves. A high school dropout can become a successful manager. However, to modify a habit, you must decide to change it. You must consciously accept the hard work of identifying the cues and rewards that drive the habit's routines and find alternatives. You must know you have control and be self-conscious enough to use it. And every chapter in this book is devoted to illustrating a different aspect of why that control is real. So though both Angie Bachman and Brian Thomas made variations on the same claim, that they acted out of habit, that they had no control over their actions because those behaviors unfolded automatically, it seems fair that they should be treated differently. It is just that Angie Bachman should be held accountable and that Brian Thomas should go free, because Thomas never knew the patterns that drove him to kill existed in the first place, much less that he could master them. Bachman, on the other hand, was aware of her habits. And once you know a habit exists, you have the responsibility to change it. If she had tried a bit harder, perhaps, she could have reined them in. Others have done so, even in the face of greater temptations. That, in some ways, is the point of this book. Perhaps a sleepwalking murderer can plausibly argue he wasn't aware of his habit, and so he doesn't bear responsibility for his crime. But almost all the other patterns that exist in most people's lives, how we eat and sleep and talk to our kids, how we unthinkingly spend our time, attention, and money, those are habits that we know exist. And once you understand that habits can change, you have the freedom and the responsibility to remake them. Once you understand that habits can be rebuilt, the power of habit becomes easier to grasp, and the only option left is to get to work. All our life, William James told us in the prologue, so far as it has definite form, is but a mass of habits, practical, emotional, and intellectual, systematically organized for our weal or woe, and bearing us irresistibly toward our destiny, whatever the latter may be. James, who died in 1910, hailed from an accomplished family. His father was a wealthy and prominent theologian. His brother, Henry, was a brilliant, successful writer, whose novels are still studied today. William, into his 30s, was the unaccomplished one in the family. He was sick as a child. He wanted to become a painter, and then enrolled in medical school, then left to join an expedition up the Amazon River. Then he quit that as well. He chastised himself in his diary for not being good at anything. What's more, he wasn't certain if he could get better. In medical school, he had visited a hospital for the insane and had seen a man hurling himself against a wall. The patient, a doctor explained, suffered from hallucinations. James didn't say that he often felt like he shared more in common with the patients than his fellow physicians. Today I about touched bottom, and perceive plainly that I must face the choice with open eyes, James wrote in his diary in 1870, when he was 28 years old. Shall I frankly throw the moral business overboard, as one unsuited to my innate aptitudes? Is suicide, in other words, a better choice? 2 months later, James made a decision. Before doing anything rash, he would conduct a year-long experiment. He would spend 12 months believing that he had control over himself and his destiny, that he could become better, that he had the free will to change. There was no proof that it was true, but he would free himself to believe, all evidence to the contrary, that change was possible. I think that yesterday was a crisis in my life, he wrote in his diary. Regarding his ability to change, I will assume for the present, until next year, that it is no illusion. My first act of free will shall be to believe in free will. Over the next year, he practiced every day. In his diary, he wrote as if his control over himself and his choices was never in question. He got married. He started teaching at Harvard. He began spending time with Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who would go on to become a Supreme Court justice, and Charles Sanders Peirce, a pioneer in the study of semiotics, in a discussion group they called the Metaphysical Club. 2 years after writing his diary entry, James sent a letter to the philosopher Charles Renouvier, who had expounded at length on free will. I must not lose this opportunity of telling you of the admiration and gratitude which have been excited in me by the reading of your essay, James wrote. Thanks to you, I possess for the first time an intelligible and reasonable conception of freedom. I can say that through that philosophy, I am beginning to experience a rebirth of the moral life. And I can assure you, sir, that this is no small thing. Later, he would famously write that the will to believe is the most important ingredient in creating belief in change. And one of the most important methods for creating that belief, he argued, was habits. Habits, he noted, are what allow us to do a thing with difficulty the first time, but soon do it more and more easily, and finally, with sufficient practice, do it semi-mechanically, or with hardly any consciousness at all. Once we choose who we want to be, people grow to the way in which they have been exercised, just as a sheet of paper or a coat, once creased or folded, tends to fall forever afterward into the same identical folds. If you believe you can change, if you make it a habit, the change becomes real. This is the real power of habit, the insight that your habits are what you choose them to be. Once that choice occurs and becomes automatic, habitual, it's not only real, it starts to seem inevitable. The thing, as James wrote, that bears us irresistibly toward our destiny, whatever the latter may be. The way we habitually think of our surroundings and ourselves create the worlds that each of us inhabit. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys. How's the water?" The writer David Foster Wallace told a class of graduating college students in 2005. And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" The water, the habits and patterns, is the unthinking choices and invisible decisions that surround us every day, which just by looking for them, become visible again. And once it is visible, it's within our control. Throughout his life, William James wrote about habits and their central role in creating happiness and success. He eventually devoted an entire chapter in his masterpiece, The Principles of Psychology, to the topic. Water, he said, is the most apt analogy for how a habit works. Water hollows out for itself a channel, which grows broader and deeper, and, after having ceased to flow, it resumes, when it flows again, the path traced by itself before. You now know how to redirect that path. You now have the power to swim. Appendix. A Reader's Guide to Using These Ideas. The difficult thing about studying the science of habits is that most people, when they hear about this field of research, want to know the secret formula for quickly changing any habit. If scientists have discovered how these patterns work, then it stands to reason that they must have also found a recipe for rapid change, right? If only it were that easy. It's not that formulas don't exist. The problem is that there isn't one formula for changing habits. There are thousands. Individuals and habits are all different, and so the specifics of diagnosing and changing the patterns in our lives differ from person to person and behavior to behavior. Giving up cigarettes is different from curbing overeating, which is different from changing how you communicate with your spouse, which is different from how you prioritize tasks at work. What's more, each person's habits are driven by different cravings. As a result, this book doesn't contain one prescription. Rather, I hoped to deliver something else, a framework for understanding how habits work, and a guide to experimenting with how they might change. Some habits yield easily to analysis and influence. Others are more complex and obstinate, and require prolonged study. And for others, change is a process that never fully concludes. But that doesn't mean it can't occur. Each chapter in this book explains a different aspect of why habits exist and how they function. The framework described in this appendix is an attempt to distill, in a very basic way, the tactics that researchers have found for diagnosing and shaping habits within our own lives. This isn't meant to be comprehensive. This is merely a practical guide, a place to start. And paired with deeper lessons from this book's chapters, it's a manual for where to go next. Change might not be fast, and it isn't always easy. But with time and effort, almost any habit can be reshaped. The framework. Identify the routine. Experiment with rewards. Isolate the cue. Have a plan. Step 1. Identify the routine. The MIT researchers in Chapter 1 discovered a simple neurological loop at the core of every habit, a loop that consists of three parts, a cue, a routine, and a reward. To understand your own habits, you need to identify the components of your loops. Once you have diagnosed the habit loop of a particular behavior, you can look for ways to supplant old vices with new routines. As an example, let's say you have a bad habit, like I did when I started researching this book, of going to the cafeteria and buying a chocolate chip cookie every afternoon. Let's say this habit has caused you to gain a few pounds. In fact, let's say this habit has caused you to gain exactly 8 pounds, and that your wife has made a few pointed comments. You've tried to force yourself to stop. You even went so far as to put a post-it on your computer that reads, "No more cookies." But every afternoon, you manage to ignore that note, get up, wander toward the cafeteria, buy a cookie, and, while chatting with colleagues around the cash register, eat it. It feels good, and then it feels bad. Tomorrow, you promise yourself, you'll muster the willpower to resist. Tomorrow will be different. But tomorrow, the habit takes hold again. How do you start diagnosing and then changing this behavior? By figuring out the habit loop. And the first step is to identify the routine. In this cookie scenario, as with most habits, the routine is the most obvious aspect. It's the behavior you want to change. Your routine is that you get up from your desk in the afternoon, walk to the cafeteria, buy a chocolate chip cookie, and eat it while chatting with friends. So that's what you put into the loop. Next, some less obvious questions. What's the cue for this routine? Is it hunger? Boredom? Low blood sugar? That you need a break before plunging into another task? And what's the reward? The cookie itself? The change of scenery? The temporary distraction? Socializing with colleagues? Or the burst of energy that comes from that blast of sugar? To figure this out, you'll need to do a little experimentation. Step 2. Experiment with rewards. Rewards are powerful because they satisfy cravings. But we're often not conscious of the cravings that drive our behaviors. When the Febreze marketing team discovered that consumers desired a fresh scent at the end of a cleaning ritual, for example, they had found a craving that no one even knew existed. It was hiding in plain sight. Most cravings are like this, obvious in retrospect, but incredibly hard to see when we are under their sway. To figure out which cravings are driving particular habits, it's useful to experiment with different rewards. This might take a few days, or a week, or longer. During that period, you shouldn't feel any pressure to make a real change. Think of yourself as a scientist in the data collection stage. On the first day of your experiment, when you feel the urge to go to the cafeteria and buy a cookie, adjust your routine so it delivers a different reward. For instance, instead of walking to the cafeteria, go outside, walk around the block, and then go back to your desk without eating anything. The next day, go to the cafeteria and buy a donut or a candy bar and eat it at your desk. The next day, go to the cafeteria, buy an apple, and eat it while chatting with your friends. Then, try a cup of coffee. Then, instead of going to the cafeteria, walk over to your friend's office and gossip for a few minutes and go back to your desk. You get the idea. What you choose to do instead of buying a cookie isn't important. The point is to test different hypotheses to determine which craving is driving your routine. Are you craving the cookie itself or a break from work? If it's the cookie, is it because you're hungry? In which case, the apple should work just as well. Or is it because you want the burst of energy the cookie provides? And so, the coffee should suffice. Or, are you wandering up to the cafeteria as an excuse to socialize, and the cookie is just a convenient excuse? If so, walking to someone's desk and gossiping for a few minutes should satisfy the urge. As you test 4 or 5 different rewards, you can use an old trick to look for patterns. After each activity, jot down on a piece of paper the first 3 things that come to mind when you get back to your desk. They can be emotions, random thoughts, reflections on how you're feeling, or just the first 3 words that pop into your head. Relaxed, saw flowers, not hungry. Then, set an alarm on your watch or computer for 15 minutes. When it goes off, ask yourself, do you still feel the urge for that cookie? The reason why it's important to write down 3 things, even if they are meaningless words, is twofold. First, it forces a momentary awareness of what you are thinking or feeling. Just as Mandy, the nail biter in Chapter 3, carried around a note card filled with hash marks to force her into awareness of her habitual urges. So writing 3 words forces a moment of attention. What's more, studies show that writing down a few words helps in later recalling what you were thinking at that moment. At the end of the experiment, when you review your notes, it will be much easier to remember what you were thinking and feeling at that precise instant, because your scribbled words will trigger a wave of recollection. And why the 15-minute alarm? Because the point of these tests is to determine the reward you're craving. If, 15 minutes after eating a donut, you still feel an urge to get up and go to the cafeteria, then your habit isn't motivated by a sugar craving. If, after gossiping at a colleague's desk, you still want a cookie, then the need for human contact isn't what's driving your behavior. On the other hand, if 15 minutes after chatting with a friend, you find it easy to get back to work, then you've identified the reward, temporary distraction and socialization, that your habit sought to satisfy. By experimenting with different rewards, you can isolate what you are actually craving, which is essential in redesigning the habit. Once you've figured out the routine and the reward, what remains is identifying the cue. Step 3. Isolate the cue. About a decade ago, a psychologist at the University of Western Ontario tried to answer a question that had bewildered social scientists for years. Why do some eyewitnesses of crimes misremember what they see, while others recall events accurately? The recollections of eyewitnesses, of course, are incredibly important. And yet studies indicate that eyewitnesses often misremember what they observe. They insist that the thief was a man, for instance, when she was wearing a skirt, or that the crime occurred at dusk, even though police reports say it happened at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Other eyewitnesses, on the other hand, can remember the crimes they've seen with near-perfect recall. Dozens of studies have examined this phenomena, trying to determine why some people are better eyewitnesses than others. Researchers theorized that some people simply have better memories, or that a crime that occurs in a familiar place is easier to recall. But those theories didn't test out. People with strong and weak memories, or more and less familiarity with the scene of a crime, were equally liable to misremember what took place. The psychologist at the University of Western Ontario took a different approach. She wondered if researchers were making a mistake by focusing on what questioners and witnesses had said rather than how they were saying it. She suspected there were subtle cues that were influencing the questioning process. But when she watched videotape after videotape of witness interviews looking for these cues, she couldn't see anything. There was so much activity in each interview. All the facial expressions, the different ways the questions were posed, the fluctuating emotions, that she couldn't detect any patterns. So she came up with an idea. She made a list of a few elements she would focus on. The questioner's tone, the facial expressions of the witness, and how close the witness and the questioner were sitting to each other. Then she removed any information that would distract her from those elements. She turned down the volume on the television, so, instead of hearing words, all she could detect was the tone of the questioner's voice. She taped a sheet of paper over the questioner's face, so all she could see was the witness's expressions. She held a tape measure to the screen to measure their distance from each other. And once she started studying these specific elements, patterns leapt out. She saw that witnesses who misremembered facts usually were questioned by cops who used a gentle, friendly tone. When witnesses smiled more or sat closer to the person asking the questions, they were more likely to misremember. In other words, when environmental cues said, "We are friends," a gentle tone, a smiling face, the witnesses were more likely to misremember what had occurred. Perhaps it was because, subconsciously, those friendship cues triggered a habit to please the questioner. But the importance of this experiment is that those same tapes had been watched by dozens of other researchers. Lots of smart people had seen the same patterns, but no one had recognized them before. Because there was too much information in each tape to see a subtle cue. Once the psychologist decided to focus on only 3 categories of behavior, however, and eliminate the extraneous information, the patterns leapt out. Our lives are the same way. The reason why it is so hard to identify the cues that trigger our habits is because there is too much information bombarding us as our behaviors unfold. Ask yourself, do you eat breakfast at a certain time each day because you are hungry? Or because the clock says 7:30? Or because your kids have started eating? Or because you're dressed, and that's when the breakfast habit kicks in? When you automatically turn your car left while driving to work, what triggers that behavior? A street sign? A particular tree? The knowledge that this is, in fact, the correct route? All of them together? When you're driving your kid to school, and you find that you've absentmindedly started taking the route to work rather than to the school, what caused the mistake? What was the cue that caused the drive-to-work habit to kick in, rather than the drive-to-school pattern? To identify a cue amid the noise, we can use the same system as the psychologist. Identify categories of behaviors ahead of time to scrutinize in order to see patterns. Luckily, science offers some help in this regard. Experiments have shown that almost all habitual cues fit into one of five categories: location, time, emotional state, other people, immediately preceding action. So, if you're trying to figure out the cue for the going to the cafeteria and buying a chocolate chip cookie habit, you write down five things the moment the urge hits. These are my actual notes from when I was trying to diagnose my habit. Where are you? Sitting at my desk. What time is it? 3:36 p.m. What's your emotional state? Bored. Who else is around? No one. What action preceded the urge? Answered an email. The next day. Where are you? Walking back from the copier. What time is it? 3:18 p.m. What's your emotional state? Happy. Who else is around? Jim from sports. What action preceded the urge? Made a photocopy. The third day. Where are you? Conference room. What time is it? 3:41 p.m. What's your emotional state? Tired, excited about the project I'm working on. Who else is around? Editors who are coming to this meeting. What action preceded the urge? I sat down because the meeting is about to start. 3 days in, it was pretty clear which cue was triggering my cookie habit. I felt an urge to get a snack at a certain time of day. I had already figured out, in step two, that it wasn't hunger driving my behavior. The reward I was seeking was a temporary distraction, the kind that comes from gossiping with a friend. And the habit, I now knew, was triggered between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock. Step four. Have a plan. Once you've figured out your habit loop, you've identified the reward driving your behavior, the cue triggering it, and the routine itself, you can begin to shift the behavior. You can change to a better routine by planning for the cue and choosing a behavior that delivers the reward you are craving. What you need is a plan. In the prologue, we learned that a habit is a choice that we deliberately make at some point and then stop thinking about, but continue doing often every day. Put another way, a habit is a formula our brain automatically follows. When I see cue, I will do routine in order to get a reward. To re-engineer that formula, we need to begin making choices again. And the easiest way to do this, according to study after study, is to have a plan. Within psychology, these plans are known as implementation intentions. Take, for instance, my cookie in the afternoon habit. By using this framework, I learned that my cue was roughly 3:30 in the afternoon. I knew that my routine was to go to the cafeteria, buy a cookie, and chat with friends. And, through experimentation, I had learned that it wasn't really the cookie I craved. Rather, it was a moment of distraction and the opportunity to socialize. So, I wrote a plan. At 3:30 every day, I will walk to a friend's desk and talk for 10 minutes. To make sure I remembered to do this, I set the alarm on my watch for 3:30. It didn't work immediately. There were some days I was too busy and ignored the alarm, and then fell off the wagon. Other times it seemed like too much work to find a friend willing to chat. It was easier to get a cookie, and so I gave in to the urge. But on those days that I abided by my plan, when my alarm went off, I forced myself to walk to a friend's desk and chat for 10 minutes. I found that I ended the workday feeling better. I hadn't gone to the cafeteria, I hadn't eaten a cookie, and I felt fine. Eventually, it got to be automatic. When the alarm rang, I found a friend and ended the day feeling a small but real sense of accomplishment. After a few weeks, I hardly thought about the routine anymore. And when I couldn't find anyone to chat with, I went to the cafeteria and bought tea and drank it with friends. That all happened about 6 months ago. I don't have my watch anymore. I lost it at some point. But at about 3:30 every day, I absentmindedly stand up, look around the newsroom for someone to talk to, spend 10 minutes gossiping about the news, and then go back to my desk. It occurs almost without me thinking about it. It has become a habit. Obviously, changing some habits can be more difficult. But this framework is a place to start. Sometimes, change takes a long time. Sometimes it requires repeated experiments and failures. But once you understand how a habit operates, once you diagnose the cue, the routine, and the reward, you gain power over it. This is Mike Chamberlain. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business by Charles Duhigg. Executive Producer, Janet Stark. Text copyright 2012 by Charles Duhigg. Production copyright 2012, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.